Hello, strong, feisty women. Some of you may recognize my voice. I'm Celine Yeager, host of the Hit Play Not Pause podcast. Throughout my career as a professional health and fitness writer and now a podcaster, I hear countless questions from women who are trying to understand how their ever-changing hormones impact their sports performance. So we decided to serve up some answers in a brand new series called Hormonal that we will be releasing on the Feisty Women's Performance Podcast feed. Throughout this four-part series, reproductive endocrinologist Dr. Carla DiGirolamo and I will be tackling topics like periods, the pill, pregnancy, and conditions like PCOS, all from the perspective of sports performance. If you aren't already, follow the Feisty Women's Performance Podcast and stay tuned for our first episode releasing on April 15th. Also, have questions you want answered? Send us a voice note at speakpipe.com/hormonal and we'll get it answered on the show.
I love riding my bike. I love running. I don't care what they think about it. I love it.
At that point when I knew I was going to win, chills just went up and down my entire body.
I don't believe there are any good or bad foods. Food is food.
I still feel so passionate about getting that record that I'm like, I'm just going to do it.
As an athlete, I was like, what's my story or what's your story? What can you learn from it and what can you teach people?
Welcome to the Iron Women Podcast. I'm Alyssa Gadeski. I'm here with my co-host and fellow professional triathlete, Haley Chura. Haley, how are you today? What's going on?
Alyssa, I'm amazing today, like truly amazing. It has been three sunny days in a row in Bozeman, like bright blue sky, not a cloud in the sky. There were a few clouds today, but it was like the temperatures are probably too warm for mid-February, but I have been wearing shorts to walk cowboy. And so that's like not even running.
Yeah.
When you're running in shorts, right? Because you're, I can generate some heat when I run, but walking is a different animal. And I walked cowboy in shorts today, which is just, I mean, again, long-term probably not good, but short-term I enjoyed it so much. Got some vitamin D, which from Inside Tracker results I know I need. So I'm in like a super good mood. You know, Olympics have been going on. I even love the Super Bowl. It's just like everything is, it just seems like things are going really well. So I'm just riding this wave. How are you?
I love that, Haley. I love it. I meant to get together some more Olympic trivia to give you this week. And then I totally dropped the ball on that. So listeners, don't get excited. There is no trivia other than Haley. I am on the road right now. I am not in my normal.
Where are you?
So I'll give you a hint. This is your trivia question. I am in the state that had, you know where I am. You know I'm in Tennessee.
So I don't want to that was the worst trivia ever.
I still have a trivia question. Okay. What is the state bird of Tennessee?
The woodpecker? I don't know.
Close. That's probably, that was a good guess. I feel like I heard a woodpecker today, actually. A mockingbird, a northern mockingbird. Oh, no, just a mockingbird, I think. So that's kind of fun. Like piece of trivia tidbit.
I mean, I was gonna say like a volunteer, but that's not a bird. All I think of is like Tennessee Volunteers, you know, because I'm in that pool. But what are you doing in Tennessee? I mean, I assume you're not like, are you in Nashville? Are you doing some country music?
Me and T Swift, she just heard that I officially became her number one fan by keeping that album on repeat, and it was like fast track to T Swift's house. No. So Haley, I've talked about this a little, like very, our biggest Iron Women super fans will have heard me drop this from very brief tidbit from time to time that over the last 4 years now, I have been trying to get into the Barkley Marathons, which many, I'm sure our listeners know. If you haven't heard of it, you can search on Netflix for the little documentary movie about it. It's like pretty dated now, but it'll give you a good insight into what it exactly is.
Wait, isn't that documentary called The Race That Eats Its Young?
It's either called, yeah, it is called that. Yes. Yes, it is.
Are you the young?
So it gives you insight. Yes. I am trying to
aspiring.
Be. I've been aspiring
young
to be eaten. Yes. For 4 years now. And it's been a roller coaster 4 years. In 2020, when the pandemic hit, I actually got in for like 2 days, and then he decided to, he ultimately decided to cancel the whole race, but like then
okay, in case someone hasn't seen the documentary, who is he? How long is it? I need a little bit of a brief reminder.
He goes by Lazarus Lake. That's like his trail name, I guess you could say, right? It's like pseudo. What's that when people have like,
this is the race director, race director.
Yeah, the race director.
Oh, his alibi. Like, wait, no. Is that right?
My brain is a little bit dead right now, but like it's his
alter ego.
The alter ego. Yes. His real name is Gary Cantrell. He is notorious in the ultra running world for coming up with races such as this one, the Barkley Marathons, Big's Backyard Ultra, where you run like 4.2 miles or whatever on the hour, every hour, as long as you can. He has a race where you run across the state of Tennessee, like literally just across the state of Tennessee, unsupported. I think the people can do it supported, but like the real race is unsupported and it's literally 500 kilometers or something insane in July in Tennessee. So he has these very notorious in the ultra running world races. They're all just like they're not standard races. The Barkley Marathons involves on and off trail racing to, that also required, like the trail is not marked for you, the course is not marked. He gives basically a verbal or a written outline of course description with like some navigation stuff, some just kind of like what he says you try and execute. And you're racing to books that he has put in the woods. You take a page out of the book to like prove you've been there. So it's a very kind of like a cult in ultra running following with this race and the people who are trying to get in and the people who get in year after year and yada yada. So
how far is it?
So the race Barkley is five loops of, it's allegedly 100 miles, but everyone knows that each loop is actually more like 25 or 26 miles with, I think he's saying this year the loops are like really, I mean, more than ever, like over 10,000 feet of elevation gain. It's like pretty, pretty crazy. And the ideal world would be to finish all five loops, but I think only 15 people, 15 men have finished in the, I don't know, 30 years or so that the race has been going on. No woman has yet to go. One woman has gone out on a fourth loop and she did not finish that fourth loop. So that's the furthest that a woman has ever gone in this race. And I'm just like, I've been knocking at the door ready to change this, Haley, for a few years here. And it has been a roller coaster because it's a process to enter. I have been on the wait list for these several years. And it's like, I have been mentally structuring the things I've been doing around, will I get off the wait list? Will I not? Can I pivot from what I'm doing to be able to get myself fit enough if I get off the wait list? And that this year I finally felt close enough to getting in that from the get-go, I have been training like I could be racing and I'm still on the wait list. Everyone listening, still on the wait list, not currently actually in yet this year, but it is really close and there is a chance. There's a pretty good chance.
How many people race?
40 every year. So okay. Not a lot of racers. And
when do you find out if you get off the wait list? Are you going to like travel to, I mean, are you in, I don't think it starts this week. This seems a little early. So this is a training thing. This is not like being on call in case you get called up, the conch shell blows and they're like, we only have 39. Where's Alyssa?
I asked if I would be able to do that and basically said no. So basically like within reasonable travel time and like prep time, right? So a few days out, probably he might be in touch and be like, can you get down here reasonably? Yes or no? Cause like once you're called off the wait list, that's your chance. You go or you're like basically done. Right. So if I get called, I need to be like prepared to go. And in my mind, I'm prepared to go like on very, very short notice. So it is, I can't give race details, but if you watch the documentary, you get to learn more about when the race usually is and things like that. And it's exciting. So I feel like I'm super fit right now, Haley, which is really exciting. I'm here. You can come down to Frozen Head State Park in Tennessee, which is where the race is. You're allowed to train on trail. So you're not allowed to do any training on your own really off of trail in the park to explore. But I have been doing a couple loops. I coach an athlete who actually lives a couple hours away in Tennessee. And I was super excited. Kat actually came in for the last few days. So I've had some company running around the trails here in Frozen Head and we've just been having a really good time. There was snow on the trail though, Haley, 16 hours south of New Hampshire and there was still snow on the trails.
What do you think of the trails? How do they compare? I mean, are they really gnarly?
So the trails themselves, I would call them like, I don't know, medium technical to actually not technical in a lot of places, but the difficulty definitely comes from the like geology, geography, I don't know, land structure of this state park. It is crazy. Like out of nowhere, these little mountains appear and you get so much up and down in this short span of time in this park that it's pretty crazy what you can put together. So like the kind of the big loop that people do when they come here training is about 20 miles or so. And you get like 6,800 feet of elevation in that time. And it's just always up and down. Like there is no flat. So it's just, it's a different kind of training getting ready for this, but it's, you know, it's similar training to things I've done for like the long trail and the Adirondacks and things like that. And the trails, like, it's just, it is beautiful here. Like rural Tennessee is a pretty amazing place. And when you're up kind of at the top lookout tower, you can see the Smoky Mountains and it's really pretty. So it's a good little secret training destination too. So if nothing else, I'll be fit, very fit after being here.
There are a lot of other people out there training.
So I've run into two other male men, I guess, racing, and they are both officially in for this year. So people are out and about, definitely scoping it out, definitely training. On, I think just the more you have your bearings, like even if you can't train off the trail, you can just kind of get familiar with the area, which is really helpful in case you get really lost during the race. You'll hopefully be able to get yourself unlost.
That does sound like a key when you're doing the race that eats its young. Well, cool. I hope we get to like, I'm crossing my fingers that your training goes well. And then you get off that wait list and you get like confirmation and we can like, you know, blow it up here on the podcast, because that is exciting to have you in it.
Thanks, Haley. Yes. Super, super excited. Haley, I'm also super excited because we have a mailbag question this week. Are we ready?
Oh, right. Yeah. I'm ready. I'm ready to answer some questions.
Okay. So our mailbag question this week is from Jill. Jill's from Connecticut. And she was listening to a recent show where Haley talked about doing most of her running on treadmills. And that when she runs on treadmills, though, she finds it feels like she has an electric assist because the belt helps her run faster. Everything's good, but then she tries to hit the road and her pace worsens, she says, by about a minute per mile. So 8 minutes per mile on a treadmill is like 9 minutes on the pavement for Jill. So have we had this experience? Do we have tips for getting treadmill running to be better, to like better simulate the roads?
Jill, I don't have that problem. I actually have the opposite. I find that I can run faster on a dry road than, you know, a flat dry road than I can on the treadmill. But I will say it depends on the treadmill. So that is the big thing, is that not all treadmills are created equal. I think that the treadmills that I typically run a little bit slow, how they're calibrated, just based off of what I've been able to do on the treadmill. And then maybe like a track, which I think would be a little bit probably more similar to a treadmill. I mean, a treadmill is great that it, you don't have stops. It is a softer surface. Controlled terrain, everything is very controlled. So one of the things I would suggest for you, because it doesn't really matter. Like, I don't know if that, like, that's kind of even what I think of when I run on the treadmill, like the pace is a guide, but what matters is the effort. And so I pretty much always wear a heart rate monitor, and that gives me kind of a different number to look at than necessarily the pace. And so I will do tempo runs, are, you know, one of my favorite exercises to do on the treadmill is like do like a tempo run, and I don't even try to hit a specific pace. I try to hit a specific heart rate range, and that is and I'll just adjust the treadmill pacing to whatever that heart rate range is, because again, I'm trying to hit a specific effort. And so do I get a little bit attached to that number? Yes. I mean, I'm only human, like then I see the number, but I think I know that it is just a number. What I'm going for is this training stimulus. And then hopefully when I, you know, get out on the road, I have a guide, you know, based off of heart rate and based off of what paces I was running, of like kind of whereabouts I'd be. But I mean, a lot of triathlons are different kinds of terrain. And I think that knowing that heart rate and knowing that perceived exertion and kind of knowing a range of what I can run at seems to work for me. So I'm not totally tied to a specific number, because I'll say, like, when I think when I run indoors versus when I run outdoors, it's almost like I run in snow a lot outside. So it's probably double the pace that I'm running on the treadmill. It's like not even comparable. But during the summer, when I do some stuff outside on the track or on a flat road, you know, I find that I actually think it's a little bit faster for me, but I get really hot too. And so that's like a limiting factor for me on the treadmill. And so I bring my own fan, but that's a story for another day. Does that help at all? I guess also like what, you know, when you're doing this too, like if you run consistently on the same treadmill, like that also helps because you know that, okay, maybe it is a fast looking time, but it's always fast and you know that, and you're getting that training stimulus. So it doesn't really matter the actual pace.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. I think you wrapped it up very nicely. I think treadmills, especially if you're using one at a gym, who knows what's going on with that treadmill? When's the last time it was calibrated? That sort of thing. So definitely going on perceived effort and or heart rate and things like that is the key. And then just like scaling accordingly, right? Like similar to how people's power meters often give different numbers, right? And so you just kind of know what yours is on that machine with those things, right? And then you kind of adjust from there for other stuff. So I think, you know, use the treadmill as a tool to help get your turnover going faster, right? Like think about that cadence moving faster so that when you are outside, you can think about trying to get your legs moving as if they were on that belt with that assist. I think that's like definitely something I visualize sometimes when I'm really trying to pick up my speed. But, you know, yeah, I don't think you want to get super attached to those numbers because unfortunately they aren't always like a one-to-one comparison. It's just different running. It's almost like a different sport. So great question though, Jill from Connecticut. Thank you so much for sending it in. And to our listeners, you can always send in questions to the mailbag at ironwomenpodcast@gmail.com. And just a quick reminder too, we always are grateful for our partners. And we are sponsored by Orca, and you can use the code IRONWOMEN15 for 15% off at orca.com. If you are gearing up for racing season and things like that, wetsuit shopping, you know, goggles, accessories. I think they have a towel poncho that we really like.
Those swim buoys. I love the swim buoys.
Yeah. Yes. Lots of good stuff. Orca.com, IRONWOMEN15 for 15% off there.
Yeah. And Alyssa, I mean, are we ready to introduce our guest? Does our guest need an introduction?
She doesn't, but we should roll out the red carpet and give her a little introduction anyway.
Red carpet is appropriate. Blue carpet. I mean, we definitely need to roll out a carpet. This week we are talking to the Tokyo 2020 Olympic champion. I mean, she's the gold medalist, Flora Duffy. And I mean, Flora was also the world champion in 2016, 2017, and 2021. She was actually the first woman, the first person to be the world champion and Olympic champion in the same year. And then she's still the only woman to have accomplished that so far. And she did do that just this past year, but she was also the 2018 Commonwealth Games champion. She's a six-time Xterra off-road world champion, which she also won in 2021. So she has been on a roll, folks. And we're really excited to talk to Flora. She helps, you know, helps walk us through that incredible race in Tokyo last summer, which if anyone's been watching the Olympics, you'll get the chills all over again. And tells us more about just her progression in the sport and what she feels like she still would like to accomplish in the future. So we'll have that conversation with Flora right after the break. Hi, Flora. Welcome to the Iron Women podcast.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for having me.
And to start this interview, I do need to double check on how to properly address you because were you just made a dame?
Yes, I was. It's kind of sounds so over the top, but yeah, just Flora is fine. Yes.
I feel like we should say Dame Flora Duffy at least once. We'll say it in the intro. And again, I just did it. I just had to. I mean, that's kind of exciting.
I know it is. I was, so where was I? Oh, I was actually in Maui. It was the week of the Xterra Worlds. The governor of Bermuda emailed me, or her secretary did, and to say, oh, Flora, the governor of Bermuda, she would like to arrange a call with you. And I was like, okay. So anyway, the next day we had a call. I'm like, you know, getting ready for Worlds in Maui. And yeah, that's when she told me the news that my name was being put forward and it was going to be announced on the New Year's honors list. So I had to keep it secret for about a month. And then, yeah, it was definitely kind of surreal and strange and, yeah, pretty special. So we'll see if, I don't know, because I know other dames like Dame Kelly Holmes, the British runner, like that's always said with her name now. And like, even for sirs, like that's also always said. So I'm like, oh, but I don't know. I haven't officially received the title, I say. So, yeah.
I think you should just go with it and start just using it all that. I mean, I definitely.
I can
tell you that. Flora, we have a very American-centric listener base. So can you kind of explain the honor a little bit for our American listeners?
Oh my gosh. now you're really putting me on the spot to like actually break down the details, but essentially,
probably won't fact check you okay. on this. So your best explanation would be good.
Okay. Yeah. So it is all, very based in British history. And so these are honors bestowed upon you by, I guess, well, since the Queen is, head of the British family at the moment. So, honors from her. And so I was nominated through my services for sport in Bermuda by our governor. So you are nominated for, achieving excellence in whatever sector you're in. And the dame and sir are sort of the highest levels. And then there's a few levels down. So I'm currently in OBE, which I was awarded after the Commonwealth Games. And then because of my gold at the Olympics, I, have been nominated to be a dame, and also on those New Year's honors list were the four from the British triathlon relay mixed relay team. They received an MBE, which I should look up exactly what that means. I should know these things. British Empire, yes. So anyway, they're kind of like cool, like I don't know.
We'll fact check ourselves in the outro or something for us.
Hopefully I kind of explained that somewhat. Okay.
I got it. It's a big deal. And I mean, it's a big deal for you, but for the sport of triathlon to have a triathlete, mm-hmm. I feel like recognized at this highest level, I think is really cool. And I think it's great that you're getting the recognition because you have had some incredible excellence during your career. And before we get to that, I just wanted to just kind of ask on less exciting news. Like so many people around the world, you recently posted about getting COVID. How are you feeling? Mm-hmm. How is your recovery going?
Yeah, so I did. I got COVID almost basically as soon as I landed back here in South Africa. So I guess the first week of January sometime, I picked it up. And I am vaccinated. I wasn't able to get my booster yet, which I don't know. Maybe if I had my booster, I wouldn't have picked it up. Who knows? Anyway, I did get COVID. I was knocked down for like 3 or 4 days. In bed with just kind of typical light flu symptoms, you know, chills, hot, cold, achy, had a headache, and just all around felt pretty exhausted. It was just kind of sleeping, for those 3 or 4 days. My husband, Dan, also thinks he got it, but he was like pretty much fine. He didn't feel great, but was like able to kind of like, you know, operate. He wasn't going to work, but like he could work from home, was fine. Whereas I was like down and out in bed, and so then that was at the end of my 6 weeks that I took off. And I really took the 6 weeks off because I was like kind of over travel by the end of last year. So I enjoyed that break and then got COVID. And then, and then so my return to training has been very, very slow, very gradual. I really had to watch my heart rate, the amount of volume I was doing. So my coach definitely was very strict on what I could and could not do and gave me exact guidelines to follow. So it's definitely been, I mean, it's kind of frustrating, but at the same time, like I really would do the tiniest bit of training. I'd be like so tired and just go back to sleep. Now I'm like 3.5 weeks post. And so I'm feeling way better now, like totally fine. And I'm able to start building into some more training, which is nice.
And so it sounds like, I mean, I guess it's kind of like, good and bad, right? It came at the end of a break. So it's not like it derailed, you know, a huge block that you were really in the middle of and kind of eager to keep going with. But what was your like mental strategy? You know, like the new year brings all kinds of feelings to people anyway, right? So it's like new year, you're just coming off a break, ready to probably start to get going again, or were you, right? Like, what was your mental strategy for kind of being like, oh, it's going to be at least another week, if not two, three, right? Before you're really feeling back like normal self again.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's funny. I was thinking about that quite a lot, because if this had happened a year before, the start of 2021, in an Olympic year, I would have been freaking out, like losing my mind, and just, yeah, really struggling. But I don't know, for me, I kind of almost started this year before I got COVID in a totally different mental space, like just such a lightness, because the Olympic build and the Olympics is done. So this year, even regardless of, oh yeah, I'm starting this year with COVID and I'm really unfit and I'm like kind of a little bit behind where I thought I would be, like, it's like, oh, it's no worries. It's not an Olympic year. That's all done. And just kind of, I don't know, I think it's taking some quiet confidence from the past year and all the years building up to the Olympics, that a few weeks isn't going to like derail my whole season. And if anything, slowing me down and holding me back is fine. So in a way, I was able to stay pretty positive through it and just kind of roll with it. And at the same time, like, almost everyone's going to go through this at some point. It depends, you know, how COVID hits you. It's really individual, but it's almost just part of, part of life right at the moment.
And so we are recording this just before the Winter Olympics in Beijing, and we know you're a Summer Olympian, but we are glad that you're here to help kind of indulge our Olympic fever. And we would love to reminisce about that incredible day in Tokyo last summer. So the first question I just kind of have logistically, like, the women race the day after the men, and I'm curious if you watch the men's race at all to get a feel for how your own race might play out.
Yes, I did. So yeah, the men raced on the Monday. Well, Monday, Japan time. Wait, I shouldn't even do days because I'm going to get myself confused. So the men raced the day before we did. And I was staying in a hotel just by the triathlon venue. So from my window, I could see the pontoon and the swim course. So I got up, I got like the streaming all set up on my laptop, but then I watched the swim from my window. And so I saw at first I didn't realize what the false start was going on. I was just like, wow, that's a really small field. And then quickly saw, you know, the whole like going back, restarting. Oh, it actually makes me nervous thinking about it. But watching the men's race start was the most nervous I was the entire time, because it was real. It was like, that is me tomorrow. Like, I'm going to be standing on that pontoon and racing for gold. Like, it's here. So that really freaked me out. And I was alone in my hotel room because Dan, he'd gone down to the race venue to just, you know, check it all out. So then I was just like there alone, just like, oh my gosh, that's me tomorrow. But then I quickly regained composure and, then enjoyed watching the rest of the race.
And so, you know, when we're watching at home, I don't know if it's editing or whatever, but it's easy to kind of assume that the execution of the Olympic events is like fairly flawless, right? But you mentioned the false start. Tokyo did seem a little bit kind of less than perfect. So we saw the media boat get in the way of that men's start. There's a weather delay for the women, quite a few crashes, and really variable weather during the race. So, you know, watching that false start, was that a reminder to yourself to like, about staying focused and how to recenter, you know, in the middle of the race when these things are going on? What are you doing to kind of stay calm amidst all that chaos?
Yeah, it's actually funny. I've never been involved in a false start. And so I couldn't imagine if that was my first time doing a false start at the Olympics. It would definitely take, you know, a lot of focus and controlling your mind space in that moment to get reset to go again. I think one of the biggest hurdles I had race week, or I could probably say most women would have had, is that on our briefing, 2 days before our race, we were told that a typhoon was passing Tokyo and there was a possibility that our race could be delayed 2 days.
Oh.
So that, now that is not what you want to hear at the Olympics.
So, oh, man.
Yeah. And the decision was going to be made at 5 p.m. on Sunday, the day of the briefing. So our briefing was Sunday morning. By Sunday evening, they would make a decision. So obviously you're spending all Sunday just like, oh my gosh, am I racing in 2 days time or is it 4 days time? And, you know, when you've had your precise taper and you've known about this date for, well, quite a while at that point, given the year postponement, those two extra days would have made like a massive difference, I think, to many people's mental and emotional states. So yeah, just processing that. Just rolling with the punches, and just knowing, you know, just, I guess, going back to thinking about all of my preparation, that I was in a confident space, I had great form, I could execute regardless of whatever day it was going to be, whatever time, whatever the conditions were going to be, just to be confident in my abilities. And anyway, sure enough, we did race on the scheduled race day. But again, I woke up, we were meant to start at 6:30 a.m. We started at 6:45 a.m. because there was a 15-minute delay. But when I woke up at 3, it was just like rain lashing the window. Wind, just like you looked out the window, you're like, oh my God, what am I going to race in? It's the complete opposite conditions of what I prepared for. We prepared for, you know, sunny, hot, humid, exactly what the men had. And then ours was complete opposite. I mean, mind you, it was still humid and it was still warm, but it wasn't that like 85 to 90 Fahrenheit we were expecting. It was more like 75 to 80, still humid, but it was windy and raining. And so we had all sorts of like cooling stuff for me to use before the race, you know, ice vests, slushies, wet towels, ice. And then none of that was used. In fact, I was like putting dry towels all over me. I had Dan's big jacket on me. I had my shoes on. And I walked out with all of that onto the pontoon and literally took it off with a minute to go because I didn't want to get cold. And it was like, in like no point in our preparation did I think about being cold on the start line at the Olympics in Tokyo in the summer. So it's just like so many different things just switched up and changed, and you just had to really just adapt as it all was happening. And thankfully for me, I've been to a few Olympics. I've raced at many high-level events. I have a lot of experience. So I was able to use all of that just to manage all of the different changing factors as the hours kind of went on leading to the race.
But Flora, in Tokyo, you came out of the water in a group of seven women that broke away during the swim, and all the medalists ended up coming from that group. So about 6 weeks before Tokyo, you raced in Leeds, where you finished fourth. And I guess in that race, you noticed a weakness in your swim. So can you talk to us about like racing in Leeds, what you learned, and how you were able to make the necessary changes to your swim in just over a month?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the between Leeds and the Olympics, I think was about six weeks. At Leeds, it's funny, the swim is so fast now in women's world triathlon racing. And I actually came out of the water, I think like 10th, which is typically not bad, but because that first, I guess it was about six of them. You had Jessica Claremont, Lucy Charles, Maya Kingma, whatever. They were just off like rockets. And coming out of the water 10th was just not good enough. Mind you, I did have some bad luck. It was the first time ever I dove in and immediately just had arms on me and just got pulled back, hit, dunked. Like I've never had that happen to me in a ITU race before. And in one sense, it was a bit of like a shock and a little worrying because that was my race for the podium over. Cause the swim was so fast at the front that like I eventually had to find some clear water. And then I did swim up to the, I guess, second little chase group behind the four that were gone. But the race was gone, right? And I was like, what if this happens to me in Tokyo? Like, I can be in excellent form, but you just have some weird bad luck where you just get swum over and hit and dunked, which can happen when 60 women are starting and going to the same boy. So yeah, anyway, that definitely scared me and maybe like overscared myself. I don't know if that makes sense. To then really focus on my swimming in that time between Leeds and Tokyo. And yeah, I just made a few changes, particularly working on my takeout speed. That's kind of, I guess, one of my weaknesses. So really doing a lot of VO2 work in the pool. Working on your VO2, settling into threshold. It's not that much fun, but that's ITU racing. And if you can't do that, then I knew I wasn't going to be in the mix for the medals, because I knew in Tokyo the swim was going to be on. It would split up. And depending on who was in that front group, I had a pretty good idea. It was going to be very hard for that chase group to bridge up. So I just knew I had to be in that front group. And I was very nervous for the swim in Tokyo. I was like, I just have to get there. And then, yeah, sure enough, I had a great swim and I felt very comfortable. And I got to the first or second boy. And I could look up and I could kind of tell I was seventh or sixth. And I could tell who the five or six women in front of me were, whose feet I was on. So Georgia's feet. I think Georgia was on Summer's feet. Summer might've been on Katie's feet and Jess. Yeah. So then I was like, okay, this is great. You just have to stay here. And then when we got onto the bike and I heard the first split back to the chase group, I was like, that's it. This is the race. This is where the medals are coming from. Now just stay on your bike because it's pouring down with rain, super slippery, lots of corners and lots of white lines. So,
and so, you know, going with that. So in the past, we have seen you make like a big solo move on the bike, and in Tokyo, it looks like you kind of sat in a little bit more than you typically would. So was that a purposeful tactic based on the conditions of the day and you knowing kind of that chase group was, you know, pretty far out of it? So like playing it, not even safer, but a little bit, you know, not going to make that move quite as much?
Yeah, I think for a few reasons, yes. One, the bike course was very technical and slick, and I just wanted to kind of get through it as safely as possible. And the second biggest reason is that I really can back my run now. So it was a 70-second gap. I didn't need any more than that. I mean, I was also confident that if I came off the bike with everybody, I could confident I could run for a medal. So yeah, taking it into all that account, I was like, well, take your pulls as you need to, but you don't need to be aggressive. You don't need a bigger gap. You just need to be smart. Continue to, you know, take in your fuel because it is still hot and it is still humid and you're going to need to run a really good 10K off of this. So just, yeah, I could just be strategic, right? And it was kind of nice that I had a few cards to play. And I didn't have to play my usual card of trying to really push the bike and try to go off the front. Mind you, that's also gotten a lot harder because a lot of the women are a lot stronger and they also know that tactic. So, yeah, a few reasons.
When you're in a group like that, are you talking to each other and making sure everyone takes a turn with their pull at the front?
Yes. Sometimes. Some people can be a little more vocal than others. But so, for example, in that group, it was myself, Georgia, Katie, and Jess. And a few others. But us four, we've raced together off the front very often, all happy to take a pull, are immediately, like, committed, right? If we can see one of us, like, within the first few meters of the bike, it's just, like, on. And we can just work together and have a common goal. There's a few others that need a bit of encouragement, some gentle encouragement, some more aggressive encouragement. So yeah, there was a few women that were shouted at to take a pull in our group. Yeah, it doesn't have to be an aggressive, massive pull. You've got to do your turn, right? So yeah, a few people definitely got shouted at, and yeah, that's typically it. Maybe you get a bit of abuse if you take a corner pretty dodgy or cut someone off. But yeah, I think that's all. I'm trying to like think back to the race. Yeah.
And so I think that you were third into transition, but you quickly found the front of the race and just kept building your lead from there. So you ended up running a 33-minute 10K and finished more than a minute ahead of silver medalist Georgia Taylor Brown. Do you remember what was going through your mind as you hit that blue carpet for the final time and ran towards the finish line?
To be honest, most of that moment was like way too big for me to take in. Like, I just think, you know, it's been years of hard work. It's been my whole like lifelong dream to accomplish winning an Olympic medal, never mind to win Olympic gold. And like, here it was happening, like just like that almost. So yeah, it was definitely special and surreal. And I can remember like, you know, consciously being like, at least in the last kilometer of the run, being like, you've got to really take this in, Flora, but also being like, I really want this to be over because I just need to cross this line, because for the last like 6 or 7 kilometers, I've been trying to distract myself that I'm not leading the Olympics and I'm not likely to win gold, you know, like, because by that time, like the gap had been established. I could tell how I was feeling, like, and then you're leading this race for, I don't know, however long, and you're just like, this needs to be over because this is like really massive, right? And like, I could feel that. So yeah, it was definitely pretty special and really nice to look back at the photos and then just to, I don't know, some of the feelings and emotions that come up. And I think particularly when I look back at the photo of Katie's running to the finish and I'm like jumping up, like cheering for her, really excited for her. And I don't know, that to me is just like such a goosebumps image. Like I, definitely a really special moment to look back at that. Yeah, just a really cool moment.
I do love that photo of you, you know, jumping, arms outstretched, really excited for an American to win bronze. And just about the kind of international camaraderie between the women who are racing the World Championships Triathlon series and the Olympic series, even though you have, you know, different countries on your front, you obviously still care about each other a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a really nice bunch of women that are racing at the moment. And I think we can all be very friends off the race course. We can be competitors on the race course in a respectful way and be excited for one another when a certain person wins and maybe you don't, regardless of their your country, which is really special, especially we race at so many events around the world and spend so much time together. It's actually like really cool that we enjoy being around one another. So yeah, then you saw at the Olympics, Katie, an American, Georgia, British, me from Bermuda. Yeah, and I was very excited for Georgia. And yeah, for Katie, both of them that I would call friends. And so, yeah, that's like pretty special that, you know, your competitors and friends. And yeah, can be excited for them regardless of what country you're from, even at, you know, somewhere at the Olympics where it's very like country dominated.
And Flora, in a recent article for your sponsor, Morton, I call it Morton. Maybe you can tell me if it's Martin or something.
Yeah, no, Morton.
I have always wondered that. Yeah. You mentioned a workout you did 10 days before the Olympic triathlon in Tokyo that let you know you could win gold. So it sounds like one of those kind of confidence boosting sets that we all kind of keep close. Are you willing to share that workout?
I am, but I like can't fully remember all of the details of it. But yeah, so 10 days out, I was doing a multiple brick workout. So it was bike run. The bike was about 8 minutes long and the run was varying distances. So I did 4 rounds of that with 4 minutes rest in between. And on the bike, I had Dan, my husband, join me. And then one of my training partners, Joanna Brown, she was racing in Tokyo. So we would pull turns and it would be pretty hard efforts. Kind of in and around, I guess, what you would take race pace pulls, I guess. But I can remember I was taking my pulls and it was on flat and Dan was like, geez, Flora, can you like relax a little bit? And I'm like, wow, That's weird. Because usually, like, Dan's a pretty strong guy. He's, you know, used to race. Like, on the flat, when he's fit, I'm, like, not really much of a match for him. And I was like, oh, wow, that's kind of cool. And I was like, this is coming so, like, feels so, like, comfortable and good. And then we got off. And the first run was a kilometer. And we're in Boulder, so we're at altitude. And I ran it in 3:07. And I was like, oh, that's quite good, like, off of a hard bike. And my training, and then so my other training partner, Chelsea Burns, was just doing the runs. And so she looked at her watch. She was like, geez, Flora, can we like chill out a little? And I was like, oh, wow. Okay. And so then we 4 minutes rest. We did that again. And I think the run was a mile. I can't remember the time though. I can just remember like kilometer ones, but anyway, and then we did it two other times. And I remember like just each time the way I was just able to back it up, and just, yeah, how I ran and how I was riding that, you know, I finished the workout and Dan, Chelsea, and Joanna were like, jeez, this girl is fit. Like, I think they definitely knew that day. And it's easy for me to look back and say I knew then, but I like allowed myself to know that, yes, whatever happens on the day, you've gotten yourself into the shape that it's possible to win an Olympic medal. And for me, that was quite comforting because it's been my lifelong dream to win a medal at the Olympics. And then it's kind of like I knew I had that ability to. I don't know if that makes sense. Like whatever happened on the day, if there was a flat, a crash, like I had gotten myself to that level, which I don't know, was really cool. And I could take a lot of confidence and comfort from that.
You put yourself in a position to win. That's all you can ask for, right? When you're sitting on the start line. I think that's so special. And I want to ask a little bit more about that same article because it was titled Weight of a Nation. So I'm curious about the pressure to win Bermuda's first ever Olympic gold medal. Did that truly feel like a weight upon you?
Yeah, definitely. Both on the side of, you know, it was Bermuda's first ever Olympic gold medal. We had our one other medal was from Montreal Olympics in 1976. So it'd been a long time since there was a Bermudian with a very legitimate as a favorite to win a medal. So I was very conscious of that. And then on the other side, or alongside of that, I had my own sort of pressures and expectations from, I guess, myself and just, I don't know, nearly everyone that's been in my circle or wherever I've trained or raced in the world. Like I'd been a favorite to win a medal in Tokyo for 5 years, the bonus year because of the pandemic, which is not fun, I will say. And there probably wasn't a day in 2020, 2021, maybe even 2019 that I wasn't like reminded about the Olympics and that I was going there to win a medal. And that was like, I don't know, my job almost. So that's definitely something. And that's probably like one of the biggest pieces that I had to get right was just mentally and emotionally getting comfortable with that pressure and expectation. Because of course, you know, every time I went back to arena, that's what everyone wanted to talk about and how's my training going and me getting excited for the Olympics and, you know, Bermuda's first chance of a medal in a very long time. And so, yeah, you're definitely very much aware that all of that is going on. And I think the biggest thing I learned to do between Rio and Tokyo is to be able to manage that and almost just kind of block it out. You know, it's like you knew it was there, but I can't really engage with it. I just need to focus in on just my training and keeping my mental and emotional state as happy as I can and just kind of knowing that's there and trying to turn it into a positive, almost of like, yes, like everyone back home, you know, has the expectation for me to win a medal and will be sitting there watching their TVs, watching me race. But just to know that like everyone there has my back and believes I can do it. And I think that was a really powerful shift for me is that like so many people believed that, I don't know, I could go there and win a medal. And yeah, that was pretty powerful.
And on October 18th, 2021, Bermuda celebrated Flora Duffy Day. Corkscrew Hill, which is a prominent feature of the WTS race in Bermuda in 2018, was renamed Flora Duffy Hill. And of course, we mentioned you're now a dame. So does the recognition, you know, kind of make the ups and downs, especially like through the pandemic, that, you know, one major, major down that you probably never would have foreseen coming, like, does that help make it worth it? Or, you know, how does it feel like to have now the recognition you deserve? Like, is that kind of fulfilling for you?
Yeah, I think the recognition is really nice. It is, yeah, pretty amazing, like how much it meant to everybody. And yeah, the I guess, you know, having the hill named after me, the holiday, being a dame, and I think those are all like, that's all really nice and special. But I think for me, the Olympics was so personal, like such a personal dream. Like, I have dreamed of this since I was like an 8-year-old doing my first triathlon. And then to have reached that, it was very fulfilling regardless of what, you know, added extras I received along the way. So yeah, all in all, it's been very special. But I think for me, what's, I've enjoyed the most is hearing people's emotional response to me winning. And in a way, that's like kind of beautiful, right? I guess if you can, you know, doing a triathlon and you can evoke an emotional response from somebody, it doesn't mean that they watch you, often are really no triathlon, but can be moved by a performance. I don't know if that makes sense. Like, that was kind of really special to hear. So many accounts of where people were watching, how they reacted, how they felt, from all walks of life, right? And from all corners of the world. I think that's just such a powerful thing about the Olympics, that everyone tunes in to watch. And so, yeah, just the amount of people that reached out to me and, you know, said that they watched, like, I don't know. For me, that was kind of like the most special. And I think also for me, I'm quite an introverted person. So when I went home to Bermuda, and it was lots of celebrating and, like, you know, like, lots of spotlight on me, it was definitely so much for me to take in. Yeah, it's also kind of weird at the same time, because you're like, well, I just do triathlon, I just wanted to win this race. And I didn't realize, like, all of this would happen, because I didn't really think about the outcome. Like, the goal was execute a great race and ideally win a medal, ideally the gold. And then you never think about, okay, you win the gold, and then what happens? And it's just like your world explodes. Yeah, it was pretty crazy.
Your world exploded, but there really wasn't much time for you to, like, soak it in and celebrate, because, you know, with the pandemic, how it changed the calendar, you had several WTCS races right after. So how did you stay focused enough through all of that Olympic excitement, winning the gold medal, Olympic champion, to have strong races in Montreal and Edmonton to score the points necessary to win that WTCS World Championship title just a few weeks after becoming Olympic champion?
Yeah, that was definitely a very intense period. Add into the fact that racing in Canada at that time, you still had to quarantine. So that was like super horrible. We had to, you know, we arrived in Canada and we just spent 3 days in our hotel room, and then you could race, and then went to Edmonton and also just stuck in your hotel room. So that was definitely, I was like, geez, I just won the Olympic Games, and now here I am, like, stuck in a hotel room in Canada. I was like, I don't know. On one hand, you know, kind of managing that. On the other hand, you're managing all the emotions of having won and the aftermath of winning, but also trying to, go for a world title. I definitely had to dig pretty deep for those two races. I really enjoyed the Montreal format with the super sprint eliminator. I think that's what it's called. The three mini races. I really liked that. A lot of people were kind of against it, but I guess for me, I've done so many sprints in Olympics that to do something so different, especially right then, was actually so fun. But yeah, it was super hard. And then for Edmonton, which was the grand final, that was probably my most testing race of the year. I was pretty close to empty. I think more most emotionally and mentally, and then to kind of get up and race at that level, it definitely, it took a lot from me. And but at the same time, it was great that I was able to clinch the world title. Doing those two back to back, I don't think I would recommend it. I don't think I will try to do that again. But it was pretty special to, I was like the first person to do it for about 2 hours, and then Christian matched me. So I was like, oh, cool. Thanks, Christian. it was pretty special. And definitely very intense. And I got back from Canada and I took a week off, and I basically just like laid in my bed and watched Netflix. And didn't I try not to talk to anybody.
And Flora, you mentioned a little bit how you have been racing at such a high level, and you've had exposure to these high level racing now for really more than a decade. Your first Olympics were in Beijing in 2008, and your progression from there has been, you didn't finish in 2008. In London, you finished 45th, 8th in Rio, and then finally the win that came in Tokyo, right? So what do you think, like, and you also touched on the fact that, you know, this isn't an Olympic year, and so it kind of is a bit lighter for you mentally, right? So there's a huge amount that's going on with your career that's tied to that 4-year Olympic cycle, or 5-year in the last case, right? So what is it that has helped you stick with the sport throughout such a long time at such a high level and kind of manage that roller coaster of riding the Olympic cycle? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's always kind of been this Olympic dream. Obviously, I really love triathlon and the lifestyle and the opportunities that it's given me and the people I've met and the places I've gone to, you know, all of that. But yeah, I think it's really just been this, Olympic dream, to be honest. And in London, I was 45th, 44th. I'd crashed. So that was, you know, a bit of a disaster. And then in Rio, at the start of the year, I can remember talking with my coach, and it was like, if I finished anywhere between 6th and 10th, that would be like an incredible race for me. And then as that year went on, I was ranked number one in the world. I'd won like the final WTS before the event. And like, you know, I'd suddenly kind of thrust myself into this outside podium person or hopeful. And that was like a whole new like set of challenges to manage, and more exposure and emotion, just everything. I was like, oh my gosh, this is horrible. And then you learn a lot from that, right? And I joined the race. And then, I don't know, from there, I was kind of like, well, maybe it's possible to win a medal in Tokyo. Just this Olympic dream has really kept me motivated in there. And there's been many, many lows along the way, injuries where I didn't think I was going to come back. I've always had a great team around me and managed to bounce back. But yeah, I'm at an interesting point now where I have achieved that lifelong goal of winning an Olympic medal. And so I'm almost kind of at a point of like, well, where to next? Or like, what, I don't know, what is driving me now? Like what? It's an interesting kind of reflection point. And I think I only really noticed it when I got back here to Stellenbosch at the beginning of 2022, because this is where I start every year of training. And, you know, the past 2 years, 2020, prior to pandemic, was an Olympic year. In 2021 was Olympic year part two. And so now that I've come back here and it's like I've achieved the gold, it's not an Olympic year. It just feels completely different. And yeah, I guess I'm just kind of like refining of exactly, why am I doing this now? Why do I keep pursuing these goals? Do I go for another Olympic cycle? Do I move up distance? And I don't know. I think for me, it's actually a really nice place to be. I guess I'm choosing to keep racing because like I want to, and I really still love it and enjoy it. And so, yeah, it's definitely, I think, a really privileged and unique place to be.
And I think one other unique thing about your progression is that you have steadily improved. And I'm curious if you follow running at all. And we just recently saw the performances, American record performances by Sarah Hall and in the half marathon, and Kira D'Amato in the marathon. And you know, those are women who are 37, 38 years old and running the best that they have. And I mean, Sarah Hall, she was a good collegiate runner, and but yet doing her best now and has just kind of steadily improved. So I am like curious about your, you know, when you look back at your progression, do you think it's experience? Do you think it's training? Do you think it is just like, okay, going one more, you know, just seeing how the next race plays out and then just building off of that?
Yes, I do follow running, and I did follow those two races, and I'm a huge Sarah Hall fan. Wow. Yeah, she's just amazing. And I hope she gives me hope, because I feel like I have so much like work done. I feel like to keep my body in one piece. So I'm like, look at Sarah Hall. She's 38 doing all these marathons and she's just rocking it. So yeah, she's incredible. But yeah, I think for me, it's just consistent years of work and maturing as an athlete. You know, whereas I've really gotten, you know, quite comfortable with just, you know, training, recovery, eating, resting, repeat. And knowing that that's going to be only for a small chapter of my life. And so just kind of like fully investing in that. And just, yeah, I guess, you know, really buying into it and enjoying that I'm able to live this lifestyle. And yeah, I mean, I guess over the years, I've had, you know, been able to bring in more resources to use, to focus more on the details, whether that's, you know, running biomechanics, working on my swim technique. I'm working with, I don't know, higher level people that I can implement. I don't know. I don't want to say new training techniques or whatever, but doesn't really make sense. But yeah, just, I guess, focusing on who is around me and my team and bringing in expertise that I think is the best in the world. And yeah, that's really just helped me improve steadily. I think, you know, not focusing on making like massive gains and being quite destructive, but just, yeah, slowly, steadily putting in the work and yeah, improving year by year.
And Flora, we definitely don't want to monopolize too much of your time, but I do want to ask. So, you know, obviously you're a summer Olympian, but you raced in Beijing in 2008. So will you be watching the Winter Olympics coming up this weekend?
I know. It's funny. I keep forgetting that the Olympics are happening. And I think that's only because I'm in the Southern Hemisphere right now and it's summer. So I can't get my head around the fact that it's like the Winter Olympics happening. And also I'm from Bermuda. So I think I will try to follow it. I really enjoy watching the snowboarding, particularly the half pipe stuff. They're just insane. I have no idea how they can do that. So yeah, I think I will try and tune in. If I need to look at the time change and everything, and yeah, but yeah, it's amazing that the Winter Olympics is able to happen. The fact that two Olympic Games will, I should say, fingers crossed, successfully occur during this pandemic. So
yes, and I just wonder if it makes you like nostalgic at all for your time in Beijing, but I imagine, I mean, it's so different because they have a very different situation with their, you know, loop and all that kind of thing than you had in 2008. So I imagine it's not the same village experience and Olympic experience.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I think Olympics are already quite highly stressful, and then you add in like COVID and daily testing and not wanting to test positive or have a, oh my gosh, no, that's that's
Beth,
not a fun side of going to the Olympics right now.
And I mean, yeah. I do admire the athleticism, of course. But Flora, thank you so much for chatting with us, for helping us reminisce about that incredible, incredible race in Tokyo, and for, you know, telling us a little bit more, giving us a little bit more insight into your champion mindset. And we're excited to see whatever you decide is next. We are excited to see it because you seem like you know what you're doing and you do everything deliberately and well.
Oh, cool. Thank you so much.
Alyssa, I loved hearing from Flora, and you know, I have all the goosebumps. I adore sport and the Olympics, and being able to hear someone relive that entire experience of winning a gold medal is just so inspiring to me. So I'm so glad we got to have her on, and she told us so much about that whole experience. And I thought it was really interesting how she brought up we brought up the camaraderie between the athletes from different countries, even at the Olympics in triathlon. And I thought that was unique to triathlon, but I've been watching the Beijing Olympics and I've seen, you know, I think it was the, you know, slope style snowboarding, and they were all like super excited when the woman from New Zealand won, and all the other competitors are like doing this mass group hug. And I've seen, you know, just these incredible displays of camaraderie crossing, you know, international borders between sports. So I think that's, maybe this is more common than I realize.
No, I agree. I think that it makes me want to be an Olympian, like hearing those stories about the camaraderie and like the teamwork and all of that. And I also have to say, my very unscientific observation I'm thinking through right here as we, as I'm like scrolling through the Olympians we've had on the podcast, they are some of the kindest like people, making time for some of these interviews with us and just being so open to share their stories and like really fun to talk to. And I don't know, I'd be interested in doing like personality tests on these people, because I feel like that element of just enjoying community and talking to one another and like learning, sharing, that sort of thing must be like a common thread, because it is, the Olympians we've had are very, you know, different. I think it is like a, sometimes a different experience getting to talk to them and just the feeling you get.
Did you see Jesse Diggins went what first win bronze? And also she was on a Super Bowl ad. I mean, Alyssa, we have interviewed someone who was on a Super Bowl ad. Did you know that?
Yeah. They heard her here first is like all I have to say.
Yes. We'll end it on that. Alyssa, enjoy your time in Tennessee. Keep us posted on that waitlist situation. And I will look forward to talking to you next week.
Bye, Haley.
You have been listening to the Iron Women podcast, hosted by Haley Chura and Alyssa Gadeski.
Iron Women is a production of Feisty Media and is edited and produced by Lindsay Glassford. Head to livefeisty.com to find more podcasts, events, stories, and fresh perspectives.
Thank you to our sponsors, Noon Hydration, Zelios Skincare, Orca Sportswear, and Inside Tracker. You can find all websites and discount codes at ironwomenpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.
Alyssa, Amino Co. has been a longtime podcast sponsor, and every time I'm listening to the show and I hear our Amino Co. ad, I'm always shocked to hear how Amino Co. co-founder Dr. Robert Wolf has run a marathon in under 2 hours and 30 minutes 62 times. I just can't believe that's a real stat.
Me either. It is very impressive, and it gives me a lot of confidence Dr. Wolf knows what he's talking about when it comes to performance and recovery. I actually took Amino Co. Heal before and after my recent knee surgery.
I've been using Heal a lot after really big workouts as I've started to ramp up my training. And I also use my personal favorite, Amino Co. Perform, before and during my hardest sessions.
Do you have a favorite flavor?
For Perform, I definitely go with the strawberry lemonade. It has a really light flavor and a little bit of caffeine that I think helps keep me focused during my really tough intervals. And for Heal, I like vanilla. I just feel like vanilla gets me into recovery mode. What about you?
The vanilla Heal is my favorite too. I find it mixes really well into my post-workout shakes that I make.
Wait, what do you put in your shakes?
Well, oftentimes just whatever I have in the fridge, sometimes vegetables, sometimes collagen, you know, whatever I have. Summer shakes are way more interesting because it's like I make them cold. But the winter shakes are a little less fancy.
Do you ever add snow to your winter shakes?
I mean, I'm going to start doing that now.
I don't know. Make sure it's clean snow. I am not quite as fancy. I just add water. I think it still works pretty well. But however you like your Amino Co., you can rest assured that in clinical trials, muscle protein synthesis from exercise more than doubled by athletes using Perform, and Heal was shown to trigger muscle growth and repair better than other high-quality protein sources.
Head to aminoco.com/ironwomen to see very large photos of me and Haley using Amino Co. products. Then select your favorite products and use code IRONWOMEN for 30% off at checkout. First time purchases also come with a free gift.
That's aminoco.com/ironwoman and code ironwoman for 30% off.
Chasing Epic is the essence of the Orca brand. It is about seeking the moments in life that make us feel truly alive and connected with the beauty of the world around us.
And let's be real, Chasing Epic is feisty.
Orca has been a longtime partner of Feisty, and we work with them year after year because we love their products and their commitment to creating amazing wetsuits made for women. They also supported me on Team USA last year at the One Water Race, which was most definitely also Chasing Epic.
With Orca's range of triathlon wetsuits, including Apex and Athlex, you can choose between flexibility, buoyancy, or a combination of both. There's a wetsuit for every triathlete and for all of your epic adventures.
And as a Feisty listener, you can get 15% off with the code IRONWOMEN15 at orca.com.
All right, Alyssa, I'm like starting to swim more again, and I feel like you were swimming a lot last year with One Water. And how did you keep your hair from getting so destroyed?
I was swimming so much last year, and I used TryHard, Kelly, and I still swear by it. They have extensively researched this problem and created a superior vegan, dermatologically tested proprietary blend. TryHard has shampoo, conditioner, body wash, and more stuff. Everything you're going to need for your pre and post swim necessities. I've also seen that top pros like Chelsea Sodaro and Lucy Charles Barkley also praise the effectiveness of TryHard. I think it's like definitely changed how good I feel just coming out of chlorine.
And we have a code right now too for anyone who wants to try, you know, try hard and stop suffering from dry, itchy skin, having their hair get all, you know, green, which happens to me because mine's like super blonde and get all beat up. You can try any of the TryHard products with the code 20feisty, that's 20feisty, for 20% off store-wide at tryhard.co. So that's 20feisty for 20% off at tryhard.co.